of this man's siblings, bar one, had died also. They had died by public execution or covert murder, for good reason or for no reason other than that the succession, his succession, must be undisputed. He was the eldest son, but he knew that the right of primogeniture ran thin where lordly ambitions were concerned. He had spared one sister only, the youngest. She had been 8 years old then, and something had failed in him when they presented him with the death warrant to sign. She was 16 now, and she looked at him always with the carefully bland adoration of a subject, but he feared the thoughts that swam behind that gaze, feared them enough to wake, sweat-sodden, when even dreaming of them. And the order lay before him still, to have her removed, the one other remaining member of his bloodline. As soon as he had a true-blood son of his own, it would be done. He would take no pleasure in it, no more than he would take in fathering. He understood his own father's life now, whose shadow he raced to outreach. Yet how envied he was! How his generals and courtiers and advisers cursed their luck that he should sit where he did and not they. Yet they could not know that from the seat of a throne the whole weighty ziggurat of state was turned on its point, and the entire hegemony's weight from the broad base of the numberless slaves through the subject peoples and all the ranks of the army to the generals was balanced solely upon him. He represented their hope and their inspiration, and their expectations were loaded upon him. The servants who washed and dressed him were all of the true race. At the heart of a culture built on slavery, there were few outlander slaves permitted in the palace, for who among them could be trusted? Besides, even the most menial tasks were counted an honour when performed for him. Of foreign slaves, there were only a handful of advisers, sages, artificers, and others whose skills recommended them beyond the lowly stain of their blood. And though they were slaves, they lived like princes, while they were still of use to him. His advisers, yes. He was to speak with his advisers later. Before that, there were matters of state to attend to. Always the chains of office dragged him down. Robed now as befitted his station, his brow bound with gold and ebony, His Imperial Majesty Alvdan II, Lord of the Wasp Empire, prepared to reascend his throne. The Emperor kept many advisers, and every 10 day he met with them all, a chance for them to speak on whatever subject they felt would best serve himself and his empire. It was his father's custom too, a part of that clamorous, ever-running life of his that had taken him early to his grave as the Empire's greatest slave and not its master. This generation's Alvdan would gladly have done without it, but it was as much a part of the Emperor as were the throne and the crown, and he could not cut it from him. The individual advisers were another matter. Each 10 day the faces might be different, some removed by his own orders, others by his loyal men of the Rakef. Some of his advisers were Rakef themselves, but he was pleased to note that this was no shield against either his displeasure or that of his subordinates. Some of the advisers were slaves, another long tradition, for the Empire always made the best use of its resources. Scholarly men from conquered cities were often dragged to Capitas simply for the contents of their minds. Some prospered, as much as any slave could in this empire, and better than many free men did. Others failed and fell. There were always more. His council, thus gathered, would be the usual tedious mix. There would be one or two Woodlousekinden with their long and mournful grey faces, professing wisdom and counselling caution. There would be several beetles, merchants or artificers. Perhaps some oddity, like a Spiderkinden from the far south, a blank-eyed moth or similar. And the locals, of course. Waspkinden from the Rakef, from the army, diplomats, consortium factors.